This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 245 for not Wednesday, it's Tuesday, September 19th, 2017. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into, and joining me tonight for a very geeky conversation is Mr. Alistair McFly. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you very much.
Hey, it's good to have you on, man. I mean, we've been talking all the time because you and I have been playing Minecraft together and talking on Discord and stuff.
So much Minecraft.
Yeah, but it's so fun. Much. It's fun. It's all good.
It is.
It's all good. Yeah. I mean, like, I've been trying to stay away from talking about Minecraft too much on the show because not everybody listens plays, and there's only a handful of the community that's actually on the Citadel Minecraft server. But it has been a really cool place. And I want to talk a little bit more about the Discord than I do really Minecraft, but because it's really the conversations that we've been having around Discord and the Minecraft server is kind of where everybody kind of gathers to hang out together and do stuff. But like the conversations are not just about Minecraft. Like I was talking to Chris today about Toys R Us filing for bankruptcy and what that means for potential Lego sales at Christmas time and all that kind of stuff. I wanted to kind of just kick off and say that I just really appreciate the community that's been kind of focused around the Citadel Cafe over the last, I don't know, 2 years. It's grown leaps and bounds since we started this Patreon. It was a Slack chat, now a Discord chat, and it's a really cool little community of people, all like-minded, just kind of like hanging out and doing stuff, of which you are a part of, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
it's a lot of fun. Like, I think you can probably attest to, like, I mean, I'm in it as like the, I guess, not the leader, but the organizer, the podcast person that the thing is built around. In terms of just like the show and stuff, but as someone that's an outsider, you know, like coming in as a listener and a member of the community, I feel like it's been a good experience on both sides, if I'm not mistaken.
Definitely, absolutely. Yeah,
I really like the move to Discord too. I got to tip my hat again to Ryan Murphy for suggesting that.
Especially for just doing audio in there as well.
Oh yeah,
just the audio chat makes things a lot easier.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. There is a Slack audio, but it's not as seamless as Discord. Because I use Slack all the time with Forge Publishing to do business calls and things like that with Piper and Dave and Rob and whatnot. But yeah, no, I think the nature of the Discord audio is excellent for what it's designed to do, which is community based, not one-on-one project stuff. It's more geared to general en masse communication, I think, which is cool. But yeah, so I mean, if you are interested in taking part in the Discord, dear listener, you can head on over to patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. It's how we support the show. If you like us and see a little bit of value in it, consider giving some value back. And then as a tip of the hat, then you also get a chance to log into the Discord. It's all automatic. You don't have to wait for me to send you a link. As soon as you become a patron, you get a link to join the Discord. So I have to get a little bit more news out of the way. I am going to be at HalCon this weekend. That is the big sci-fi fantasy comic convention here in Halifax. I have a table. I'm going to be at H16. You can find that on the website hal-con.com. And I'm not going to be alone. We also have a visiting artist in town, Piper Thibodeau from Daily Paintings fame, is going to be a guest at HalCon. We've known this for a while, but we had to wait for HalCon to announce it officially. And I believe this is the first podcast I've done since they've announced that. So want to let everybody know that you're in the Halifax area and you're a fan of Piper's, or if you're a fan of my artwork, then you can come to HalCon and visit us. Piper is at table A9. She's going to be in the guest area. So you can go in and see her. She's going to be doing a drawing demo at one of her panels. She's going to have a ton of books with her. They all arrived at my studio today. We shipped them here just because it was easier than her taking things on the plane. So they all arrived today. There's a bunch of prints and stuff from her as well, which if anybody has been following Piper's work, she's been at this for 5 years. One painting a day has never missed a day. She was late once, I think, when her mother had to go to the hospital for knee surgery, but that's it. Like, I mean, Christmas, she doesn't miss a beat. This is the first time you're going to be able to buy a book from her in person or buy a print from her in person. First time ever. So she's really excited about it. I've been working with her for 3 years, and we've actually never met in person, so this is going to be a first for us as well. So if you're going to go to HalCon, please go say hi to Piper. Tell her that you love her work if you're a fan, because she deserves it. She's probably one of the hardest working people I know, and it's been an absolute pleasure to work with her over the last couple of years, so please go do that. And I'm going to be at my table as well. I'm going to be selling prints, and I'll have some of Piper's books at the table, but mostly I think I'm going to be directing people to go say hi to Piper, because you can buy a book from me, but you can get one signed from Piper, so... why would you want to buy one from me when you can get them from Piper? But I'm going to have some extras in case she runs out, stuff like that.
It still astounds me, not just how much she's done, but the quality, the fact that that's just done in a day for each drawing. Oh,
it's insane. Well, and not just a day, like she's got her own client work she has to work with too. I talked to her one time. It didn't used to, but I think she has it down to somewhere between 90 minutes and 2 hours. It depends on the subject matter, the number of characters and stuff, and how much time she has. If she's got all afternoon, she might kind of pump out something a little bit more detailed, or save the ideas that require more work for days when she has more time. But
sometimes it takes me that long just to get out of bed in the morning.
Oh, me too.
She's already done an entire miraculous piece of artwork. Yep. It's incredible.
Yeah, no, I set my alarm this morning at 5:45, and I don't think I get out of bed until 6:45. I didn't sleep. Like, I was in there, but I was reading Twitter and checking in. I mean, the first 20 minutes I'm awake, I don't generally get out of bed anyway. Like, I tend to just kind of like warm up to it because I don't have to. It's one of the nice things about working from home is that you can kind of like, well, I have to be in the studio by 8 or 9. Like, that's the goal. But I like to get up somewhere around 7, give myself some time to make breakfast and chill out. Like, I don't have to catch a bus or leave. So it's nice in that way to like take your time. I'd rather get up early and have lots of time than get up at like 7:30 and try to be in the studio by 8. Like, that's just dumb. You know, like, even at home, I wouldn't have enough time to like enjoy a cup of coffee and, you know, make a proper breakfast.
Mm.
Are you an early riser? I don't think I've ever had this conversation with you. Do you get up really early, or do you just get up like with just enough time to get to work?
Usually the latter. It depends a lot, really. I still remember though when I first came here, because if I can get an extra bit of lie-in, I will do that. Mm-hmm. I will stay in bed and just relax and do, like you said, like check Twitter and or just catch up on all that kind of news and stuff. But when I moved here from the UK, with that time difference, I suddenly became a morning person for like the first 3 months I was here. Because of the time difference. It's just kind of like, you know, I wake up and it's only 6 a.m., but it feels like it should be almost midday.
Yeah, yeah. Wait, is it 6 or 8 hours difference?
It's actually only 4.
Is it really only 4? Really? Huh.
Yes.
Longer.
No, just where we are right on the coast, it's not too bad. So, like, if it was New York, it would be 5 hours.
5 hours, right.
And so on. So, but it's, 4 hours isn't bad, which does make keeping in touch with people a little bit easier.
Yeah. Well, and I've noticed, I've kind of figured out about what people's schedule are, because a lot of the Minecraft streamers that I follow are from Britain. And when they go live on Twitch, my phone kind of gives me a little ding. I often can't check it out because it's usually in the middle of the afternoon. But for them, it's like after dinner. It's their after dinner evening stream. Like, they're chilling out for the evening and playing video games and streaming on Twitch for their evening. But it's 4 o'clock, you know, here. So I was like, I'd want to watch that, but I probably shouldn't because I got stuff to do and I'll be distracted if I have that on in the second monitor. And every once in a while I will, depending on what they're doing. If they're playing something really intense, then I won't watch. But sometimes if they're just like, well, we're hanging out and talking and they're just digging a hole in Minecraft, it's like, well, okay, well, that's fine, because I don't have to watch them do anything. They're not building anything interesting. That is an easier stream to kind of jump in on. Although I'm disappointed. I've been exploring Twitch quite a bit because I've been doing some streaming myself. It's twitch.tv/JoelDuggan for anybody that's interested. I keep it pretty casual, but I've been trying to, you know, pop into other people's streams, see how they do it, learn a little bit. I still don't know the technical side of Twitch very well because I haven't taken the time. But one thing that is really annoying is that to be, I don't want to say multitasking, but to have someone stream on in the background, whether it like you're listening to music or like you're watching a TV show while you're working, Twitch kicks you out of the chat after being idle for so long. So then you're sitting there listening and paying attention while you're drawing or whatever, and then you go to chat and you can't. You have to then log in again, watch an ad again, and by that point, whatever thing you had to type is, well, old news because the stream is going a mile a minute for these, you know, popular Minecrafters. And so like I find it very frustrating to try and engage. I don't have the time to just sit and watch someone stream on Twitch. I appreciate the people that come by my stream and do it, but I don't have the time. On weekends I have done, like I've some Saturday streams from Iskall 85 and some other people I've watched for like an hour or so. And that was really cool to be able to actually like be there, you know, like throw it up via AirPlay onto my TV and then be in chat on my phone. So like I actually have, like I don't have to be at the computer. I can kind of kick back and relax. It's been a really fun experience. Do you watch many streams?
Not really. To be honest, it's mostly been just watching episodes up on YouTube. And part of that is just timing, and it's just easier to do that. And then I can pause it and always come back later and stuff.
Yeah,
obviously I know you can do with Twitch. You don't have to watch it live.
No, it's true. Yeah, you can go back and watch it later if you want. I find that the approach to streams is different, though. For some of these really popular streamers, like half of the things that they say are just thanking people for making donations and stuff, which I appreciate. Like, I mean, the people that are spending, you know, they're subscribing for X amount a month for like, you know, 6 or 8 months in a row. It's a decent chunk of change that they're giving these streamers for their entertainment, which is amazing. But when you're watching a really popular streamer and you're used to watching their YouTube videos where they're talking about what they're doing and why they're doing it all the time, to have sentences basically interrupted or thoughts interrupted by, oh, thanks, you know, XK597 for your awesome donation. And this just goes on and on and on. And it's just like, well, at what point, like, why am I tuning in to just listen to you thank people constantly? I like the idea. Some people have, and I have no idea how this works. I do need to look into it, but some people have like automatic stickers or badges that kind of pop up on the screen. So if the
person, I've seen a couple of those before.
Yeah. So if the person is speaking and talking about something that they don't want to stop and interrupt themselves, the thank you still pops up. Like it's still, the rest of the world is notified that, you know, this person has donated and this person has subscribed or whatever, which I think is really cool.
I do like, just as sort of a thing on it, is that people do donate. You know, I know that kind of like when streaming first became a thing, it was all kind of, you know, well, I want that for free. Why should I have to pay for anything? Mm-hmm. And the fact that people are still paying to support people for creating entertainment, as you said.
Yeah.
I think is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. And I think, and a lot of these guys and girls will have Patreon pages as well, just like we do. And I think that it's a nice kind of mentality that's kind of shifting online right now. I read an article, I want to say 2 weeks ago, from Jack Conte. He's the CEO of Patreon. And he was explaining, you know, the shift. And what we're seeing is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the accessibility and the trust that the general public has in online payment systems like PayPal, now Patreon, that has a track record. Twitch has got some good, I wouldn't say a lot of good faith with its users, things like that. And you're not asking for the moon. Like you're saying, hey, if you have some chump change and you want to donate, it's $1 a show or it's $1 a stream. Or in some cases, these people were subscribing at like the $5 a month level for 6 months. I mean, it's $30. It's not the end of the world. You know, it's a cab ride, you know, but when you add that up to someone, I'm using Iskall 85 as an example, just because that's the last guy that I watched stream, who's got, you know, 2000 people in the chat room at any given point, maybe not two, maybe more like 1000 people, but he probably has around 2000 followers. When you start getting that number up there and every other person during his stream, as I said, is very busy and they're donating between $1 and $5. Like that's fantastic. I mean, that's an excellent, you know, source of revenue to allow him to recently actually leave his job and go full time, which I, you know, it's the same thing. Like when I, for me, it's podcasts. Like when I'm on Patreon, most of my money is going to support either other artists, like independent creators, like, Nicholas Cole, who we had on Comics Coast to Coast a couple weeks ago. I think I'm $2 a month on his site for Patreon because it gives me access to his behind the scenes videos. Like he does like tutorial videos about color and stuff like that. If you go to patreon.com/jellybots, you'll see his work and you'll understand exactly why I want to watch a video tutorial about color from this guy. Like he's phenomenal. He's also a super nice guy. So like, I absolutely have $2 a month, you know, like when I used to work a lot of times outside the house, that was less than the coffee that I would buy 3 times a week, you know, and it's not like it's, you know, because I run a Patreon page, I know that Patreon only takes about 10%. So for every dollar, the creators get about 90 cents. Which is really good. Bad. Yeah. That's no, really for, good, yeah. Yeah, for online payment systems and stuff like that, like that's fantastic. You know, for, to be able to have like the system and the trust and the monthly, you know, the paywall, like to have this, for the services that you get and they're getting better. Patreon, I really think is a game changer. And I think it's done a lot to pave the way for places like donating on Twitch, for PayPal donations as opposed to buying things. Like you can, I have it set up, but I don't have it advertised anywhere, but you can just get like a PayPal pay me site where it's not for goods and services. It's for tips. It's like similar to, it's basically for the people that don't want to have a Patreon account. They would prefer to just donate whenever they can rather than have it be auto deducted monthly. Anyway, it's a really kind of a neat, system. And I've subscribed to a couple of Minecraft YouTubers and stuff like that, just because I find that I'm watching their content more than I'm watching Netflix. So I thought, well, you know, I'm paying $10 a month for Netflix, which I'm watching, but not, you know, quite as often. So I thought, well, you know, like these are bite-sized, as you said, you know, YouTube videos that are like 20 minutes long that you can kind of pause and come back to when you want to, and or reference when you need to like learn something. It's been super cool. But that's actually not the only thing that I have been watching. I want to mention this really quickly because we've got some Star Trek stuff to talk about. Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. I was in the mood for something a little bit fantastic over the weekend, and I watched this, and I really enjoyed it. I'm a Tim Burton fan usually. I go in expecting weird, and you usually get that. I think the last thing I tried to watch from him was, did he direct the Oz movies? Like the or is it the Alice in Wonderland? Is the Alice in Wonderland ones?
It's the Alice in Wonderland ones. I can't remember who did the Oz related ones.
Yeah, but yes, similar kind of vein. I wasn't a big fan of the Oz ones or the Alice in Wonderland ones. That was just a little bit too over the top for me. And Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children is over the top, but it's over the top in a very Tim Burton way. Like I was explaining to you in pre-show, one of the gifted kids, floats. She can fly, but she's not like Superman kind of flying. She's like a hot air balloon and she needs to be weighted down or she will fly away, or float away, I guess I should say. Asa Butterfield, I believe that's how you pronounce his first name. Is an actor that I've been watching for a while. I think ever since, was it Hugo? I think was the movie that he was in that really caught my eye. He's a lot older now, a lot taller.
Is this? Is that the
kid?
The guy who played the little kid?
Yeah, little kid, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Fantastic actor.
He was great in that film.
Excellent actor. He's really kind of come into his own. A lot of really subtle things that you can pick up on with him. He's in a weird movie and he's playing a slightly awkward kid, but it's a Tim Burton film. Like that's kind of the role, that he's slated for. And I would say probably playing to his strengths a little bit. He's kind of an awkward, you know, awkward kind of guy in terms of how he's been, the roles that I've seen him in. And, it was a really good movie right up until the very end. I won't get into spoilers just cause I do think people need to see it just for its own merits of being very different. Like, it's just the kids have got these weird and like surprising in an imaginative way. You know, like there's a little girl that's super strong, like can lift. She lifts. I can't remember his name. Stan. Ace's character is Jake. So Jake arrives at this home for peculiar children, and he's greeted like, "You should come play with me." And she's like, "I don't know, 5." And she picks up the 16-year-old like over her shoulder and just like walks off with him. and like it's really really fun stuff. And it's just these weird little nods. Like the powers that they have are not necessarily useful. They're just peculiar, as the name suggests. Like one kid is full of bees. Bees. You're like not super practical or useful, kind of weird and annoying, but so, and this is all the kind of stuff. And there's a really good reveal close to the end, which I won't spoil, but there's twins and they just keep on calling them the twins this whole time. And they're in these 1940s head to toe pajama clown suits with masks on. You never see their face the whole movie. They've got like kabuki masks, like these little slit eyes and teeny tiny little mouths. And they don't speak. They kind of growl the whole time. So the whole movie, you're wondering, what the hell do these kids look like, right? Because they don't even sound human. And they do absolutely everything in sync. Like when they walk, everything is like left, right, like they're marching together. Anyway. It's a really rewarding moment later on in the film when you actually get to see them. And it's just one of those things where you can't make this stuff up. Like, I mean, me going in and thinking about kids with powers, immediately I start to borrow from like X-Men and Superman. Like you start to borrow from the superhero canons that we all know. Mm-hmm. And these things are just like, they basically said, okay, whatever we do with these kids, it can't be currently in comics. Like, just can't, you know? It's that different. So if you're in the mood for something that's a little bit bizarre, some overacting, but it fits on the characters that are supposed to be that way. Like, Miss Peregrine is, like, way over the top. But it works, because that's, like, she's an archetype, right? Like, that's what she's meant to represent, you know, certain things. But yeah, I would highly recommend it. It's on Netflix, you know, Netflix Canada. Check it out. I'm quite interested actually to kind of catch up and see what other things that Tim Burton has done in the last little while and see if I can't bring myself up to speed. Are you a Tim Burton fan?
I was. I definitely liked a lot of the stuff that he was doing in the 80s and 90s. The more recent stuff, like we were saying with the Alice in Wonderland stuff, I've not been as keen on. So like that and the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory film that he did.
Yeah.
You know, I think his style has gone... I mean, it's hard to say his style's gone weird because that is his trademark style.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's drawing to me.
Filmmaking and special effects and stuff like that have really kind of allowed him to go weirder. Like, I feel like he might have been hamstrung by what was believable and affordable, you know? I love Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice is a classic. Favorite of mine.
Yeah, that and Batman are like the go-to things. When somebody mentions Tim Burton, one of those two will be the first to pop in my head.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think Batman, but I don't necessarily remember that fondly. Like, that to me doesn't hold up. Where Beetlejuice, product of his time, but still kind of holds up as an entertaining movie.
It was creative with a lack of resources. Like you're saying, like with effects and stuff were being so limited back then.
Yeah.
To do what he did, especially on the budget that they must have been on.
And there's even some special effects in Peculiar Children that if it wasn't stop motion, it was made to look like stop motion. Like it was very, very much a nostalgia bump to like Beetlejuice type stuff with like the sandworms and like all that kind of thing. So I'm curious to see, you know, if there can be a mix of that kind of stuff going forward. Because we've seen a lot of that recently where things like Stranger Things and some other weirder shows have been using a mix of practical and CG effects. You know, CG whenever they have to, but otherwise it's kind of like... It has that 80s vibe, and I feel like there's something about having a practical mask or a suit or something versus, you know, a CG thing. I really enjoy the kind of costuming or special effects where it's mostly costume, but then something is animated, like, you know, like the giant hawk wings or something are obviously animated, but everything else is actually like a physical thing. And, and I find that that kind of stuff is way more interesting, than not, than having it be CG. To kind of bring us over into Star Trek, I recently watched, Star Trek, what was it called? The latest one, the Frontier?
Enterprise?
No, the movie. The latest film.
Star Trek Beyond.
Beyond, right. Fantastic film. Really, really fun. Did not notice on the big screen, but watching it on the small screen, one scene where Kirk is doing the distraction with the motorcycle while they're rescuing the Enterprise crew. And it is bad green screen. Like, it's... You're just like, wow, okay, I might as well be in a car in the 70s with the road on a screen behind me going by. Like, it did not, it stuck out like a sore thumb compared to all the other fantastic effects and both, and a lot of practical stuff, you know, in that particular movie. So I don't know, it's something to me, like when that kind of stuff works, like you really kind of, these days you really have to sell it. And I think sometimes the practical effects are the way to go.
Oh, absolutely. The more you can get in practical effects, the better it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of where my nostalgia bone is anyway. So to talk about Star Trek, it's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show, because I know that you're just so knowledgeable with this kind of stuff. And we are, what, 5 days away from Star Trek Discovery?
5 days.
Nice. So this
four
is
six for the rest of the world.
That's true. North America.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah. And for me, like, this is the first time in a long time, probably since Enterprise, that I'm going to be able to watch and hopefully stick with a new Star Trek series as it's happening. I've watched Enterprise, but I went back and watched it. Like, I didn't watch it live. I tried, but it was a something that I watched because it was on immediately after Smallville, not because I really wanted to. It was more like, I'm going to be home anyway. So yeah. Eventually I fell off and didn't continue with it. I finished it later on. I finished it last year. But I'm looking forward to something new. And a lot of what I'm feeling is that it's really going to be, pardon the pun, a sense of discovery for me, because I know next to nothing about this outside of things that I've heard on like anecdotal comments and podcasts, possibly conversations with you, where the focus is on the first officer, not the captain.
Yes. Which is a definite first for the series.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, there's some cool things like that I think are gonna, you know, present themselves. But it premieres on the 24th. It's a CBS show, but I think here in Canada, you mentioned that we get it in space.
Space and CTV.
Okay.
So they're showing two episodes to begin with. And my understanding is that the first episode is available on both of them. And then the second episode will be exclusively on Space. Okay. And from that point on, the day after, they'll start appearing on Crave TV.
Wow. That's not complicated at all.
No, not in the slightest.
Yeah.
In America, they've got it on CBS. And then it moves, they do the first two episodes, and then it moves to their old digital service called CBS All Access. Okay. And everywhere else in the world, the UK, Germany, France, everywhere else, it's on Netflix.
Oh. and usually...
How painful is that? So they have to wait a day for that, but... Oh, I wish it was on Netflix here, but US and Canada... Completely different story.
Even like next day, you know, because I used to do that with the 100. I don't watch it anymore, but when that was on, it might still be on, but when the CW was running that, I could watch it on Netflix like a day or two later.
Yeah.
I feel like it was a Thursday show and I was watching it on Friday nights or Saturday morning. So I feel like it was just 24 hours later and it would be on Netflix, which is fine. Like, I don't mind waiting a day if it's on a service that I'm already paying for and then I can stream it and pause it and like no commercials and all that kind of fun stuff. I'm really surprised that, you know, trying to launch a new Star Trek franchise, as popular as this IP is, especially with the latest movies doing so well, that it's not like more accessible. Like, how is it not a full just television series? Like, whatever network had that and decided to do network television with it would be just raking in the money, I would imagine.
Well, it's CBS. And it's a very interesting kind of thing. And I've had to read up a lot just to get my head around it. Because when it comes to who owns the rights to everything, is CBS right now.
Okay.
There'd been a bit of a history, and this is why there's a difference when it comes to the Star Trek movies like Star Trek Beyond and so on, and this, because there was Paramount sort of back in the day, and there was Viacom, and Viacom ended up splitting. So Viacom became CBS Corporation, and then there was a new Viacom that was created that's the one that owns Paramount Pictures, and they're the ones that are doing the Star Trek films.
Oh.
But yeah, so it's actually a completely different company that's doing the movies. And then you've got CBS. Now, they were launching their online digital series, and they thought, what better to launch that than to put something as big as Star Trek on there?
Right, okay.
So they wanted that as like an exclusive thing. They wanted it for the launch date. They actually wanted it to be the moment that when there'd be Star Trek on there, but there were delays. And part of that was holding out for Sonequa Martin-Green to star as the first officer, Michael Burnham. And she, is of Walking Dead fame. And so that was one of the main reasons there, plus trying to make sure that they had the time to get everything else done for it. But it's definitely interesting with the way that the licensing has worked, because CBS, being the main rights holder, they have access to everything, which is why it's set in the canon universe. So the prime timeline, and basically the same as everything that we've seen before.
Right.
When Paramount were making the new Star Trek movies with J.J. Abrams, with his Bad Robot team, they had the rights to make movies, but they did not have the rights to the characters. They had to license those. So that's one of the reasons why. So they could license the characters, but they couldn't license, at least this is from what I've read, they couldn't license the look and feel. So that's why everything looks so remarkably different, apart from them just wanting to modernize stuff. But they apparently couldn't even get the exact shade of color that they had in the original series for the uniforms. And it's also why they had all these patterns over them as well. Again, it was like everything that they could do to differentiate it, they kind of had to. And they ended up getting into a bit of an argument. There was a lot of feuding between the two companies trying to agree to all the licensing and stuff, that merchandise never happened. There was a little bit of merchandise, but like, if you try and find stuff from the movies, there's very, very little. And that's just because they couldn't organize it. So they didn't manage to get a ton of money from those. And I remember reading that J.J. Abrams were getting really frustrated and angry, because they'd envisioned that they'd also be able to get all of the toys and models and things, and get all the the money from that. And that just never surfaced. Whereas CBS, because they have this entire show, they have the rights to do that. And they have licensed this out to so many companies. They've got QMX, who are doing all of the replica prop badges. McFarlane are the main company that are going to be doing all the toys. They have everything. And they haven't just given McFarlane the license for Star Trek Discovery. They've given them the license for every single Star Trek property out there.
Wow.
So there's going to be so much merchandise coming off the back of all of this. And we're going to finally see another wave of Star Trek stuff coming out, which, I mean, Star Trek was heavy in the 90s. I mean, you mentioned about Toys R Us going through possible bankruptcy, which I didn't even realize. But in the 90s, I remember going there and there was an entire row, an entire aisle just full of Star Trek stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll probably end up being back at that kind of point.
Wow.
Assuming they don't go under as a company.
Maybe not in box stores, but certainly on places like Amazon. And
oh, yeah.
You'll see it in places like Comic-Cons, like HalCon. Vendors will have, reams and reams. of this kind of stuff. I'm actually curious to see this weekend, like what kind of Star Trek Discovery fandom is going to be happening at HalCon. I mean, not that people can be really fans yet because it doesn't come out until after the convention. But there's a lot of people that are very, you know, I guess, there's high anticipation. That's the word I'm looking for.
Well, it's been so long since, it went off the air. I mean, you know, when you think about how long ago Enterprise was, you know, it's insane. It's, was it 2005 it went off the air, or was that when it came on? Let me just,
It was on in 2000 and I think it might've started in 05.
Yeah,
because Smallville was something I was watching in this apartment.
No, it was 2005 it finished. It started in 2001 and ended in 2005.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
12 years ago. It's been more than a decade since Star Trek went off the air.
No kidding. Wow. I guess for me, because I watched it so recently that I don't feel that way. But yeah, no, that's... I guess it's sort of... And it makes sense, too, because when I was watching, it's like, yeah, this starts... It started to feel like an older TV show, you know? I liked Enterprise when I first watched it on TV back in like 2001, 2002. But I ultimately didn't like it enough to keep up with it. I think that was the breaking point for me.
There was a lot of struggle as well. You know, I mean, it ended up getting canceled. The original series for a start that got canceled, in its third season. So it's not the first time that that's happened, but we ended up with Next Generation, and then we ended up with Deep Space Nine that kind of overlapped. And then when Next Gen went off the air, we had Voyager, so that was overlapping with DS9. Mm-hmm. And then that ended, and we ended up with Enterprise. And that was Enterprise was the first time it was being run again by a network since the original series. And there was so much network interference that it really had a rocky start and wasn't the show that they'd originally intended to put out there. By season three, they did a whole season long arc, and that's where the show changed and became really good.
Yeah.
Because, you know, up until then, every episode had been pretty much a standalone episode. Deep Space Nine did do somewhat of an arc. But it was all kind of serialized storytelling for the most part. And I mean, obviously, I'm a huge fan of the series. I love the franchise, but critically speaking, it was starting to reach fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And it did end up, obviously, getting cancelled at a point just as the show, as Enterprise was getting really good. But to have brought in another show immediately afterwards wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
I think at that point, it kind of burnt out. And so it needed to be off the air for this time. And that's why I was glad for the JJ movies. You know, it's one of those, love them or hate them, it needed to still be there to still keep it kind of in people's conscience. And also, more so for studio executives who might bring it back to TV someday, which finally now they are.
Yeah. And I like the mood of the Abrams films. Like, I find them fun. Like, they've got some serious moments. They've got some gravitas, but there's a lot of light, not necessarily funny moments, but just light adventure moments is what I'll say. Having watched Beyond so recently, you know, and like Scotty is hilarious, you know, in those movies, and like so much of like how they survive in Beyond is just luck. It's just, you know, like,
yeah,
your pod landed 6 inches to the left instead of the right, and that's why you're alive. You know, also because you're a main cast member and we want to make more movies. But like, you know, like it's that kind of thing that you can, because they've set it up that way with the other films, you can absolutely accept it, because the characters even acknowledge the fact of like, whew, that was close, well, I should go find the captain, you know. and so little nods like that are just like, it's just enough of that kind of mentality. I've always found the television series to be a lot more serious than the films. Even the old, like, not Generations, but like the films with Kirk and McCoy and Spock and those guys, like, you know, I can't remember the names of them, but like I found those to be also less serious than the television show that I would have known at the time would have been Next Generation. But I found that was more of a serious show. There was more laughs in the movies. Maybe, again, absolutely, because they have the freedom, you know, they don't have the network kind of over them. And also, it's not a 45-minute show. Like, I mean, there's a little bit more room for some character development and some lighter moments and stuff.
They did have, yeah, I mean, they certainly had a lot more humor in Voyager, and they did at times in Deep Space Nine. They were able to have quite a bit of fun with that. Next Generation, especially when it first started, the first couple of seasons, very serious show. Yeah. But this is where TV and film are different for Star Trek. The movies tend to be more, I'd say they try and put more humor and action into those because it's more fitting for a film. Whereas there's more drama and more serious in it, and they're able to really dig deep into big issues.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that's
because they have the time to do so on TV.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, because you've got a whole season, you know. How many episodes are in the first season of Discovery?
15.
So it's short. Well, that's good, though. I would rather have a good short season, you know, take a page from Game of Thrones and make them count, as opposed to something that's 22. And then by 13, you're like, oh, God, this is dragging, you know?
Yeah.
So do we know if they're going to be kind of going down that road of a serious drama addressing some issues, like kind of?
They are, yes. It's going to be a pretty serious show. They're really putting a lot into this as well. I mean, when we're saying about like 15 episodes, they're doing it as a season one arc. They've already got season two pretty much planned out. They've got a rough idea for what they might do with a season three if it gets that far.
Wow, so they've already got some plans.
Yeah, and they're doing different things. So season one, and we'll probably talk about this in a little bit more depth, but they're focusing on the Klingon War. And then season two, they've not really announced anything about what they're sort of wanting there. But CBS do refer to Star Trek still as the family jewels. And you can tell just how much they're trying to make sure that this thing works. I mean, the budget for this thing is probably one of the biggest that we've ever had for Star Trek. I mean, the set and everything. I mean, each episode is costing them about $8 million upwards.
Jeez.
Right. Wow. The Klingon ship that they've made, that set alone cost them $3 million. And to put this in perspective, Game of Thrones, which has 10 episodes per season for the most part, started at $6 million and is now about $10 million per episode. And they're starting out with 15 episodes at about $8 million upwards.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I mean,
so they're really funding this thing.
Yeah. Well, and it's an established IP too. I mean, I think that I think the only thing that might hurt them is just underestimating how many people are going to have to jump through hoops to watch it.
Well, this is the interesting thing, because they've licensed it out to places like Netflix.
Well, I guess yes. I'm thinking locally, but yeah.
Yeah. I think it was a couple of months ago. I think it was around that kind of time frame, they announced that they'd already hit half the budget just from licensing alone. And that basically by the time it airs, most of the costs will already be done. So it's already profitable before it's made it to air.
Nice.
Which is huge. And yeah. It's very reassuring as well.
Well, and it allows them to write long term, right? It allows them to write arcs like you're mentioning, as opposed to trying to keep it episodic just to kind of keep people coming back. Like they can approach it as an investment, I guess. Just so I'm clear, because I've heard this but I don't remember, when in the timeline is this taking place?
So this is set in the year 2255, which is 100 years after Enterprise, and in terms of the original series, it's 10 years before that show. So Kirk and stuff. So at this point in time, the Enterprise actually exists.
Yeah, I was gonna say, so Kirk's alive. Like, he's a person, not on the show, but like in this universe at this time.
Mm.
Kirk is alive.
He is absolutely alive. Because the Enterprise originally launched in, I think it was 2245. And that was under its first captain, Robert April, and that was a five-year mission. And then it ended up under Christopher Pike. So Pike, you'll know from the JJ movies,
right?
As the captain that was there. He was also the captain in the first pilot for Star Trek called The Cage before NBC went, no, just get rid of it and change the captain and make another one. He actually let them make a second pilot. And that was 2254. So at this point, Pike has been captain of the Enterprise for about a year. There's no word as to whether we'll see the Enterprise or Pike. They've refused to actually answer that question, so it could be one of those they're holding that back.
Which is good. Like, I mean, if they're refusing to answer that, I mean, that kind of, I don't know. I mean, it you don't know, but it kind of says yes. But we don't want to spoil. I mean, how cool is that moment when, you know, something bad is happening with Discovery and they need help, and then out of nowhere, just whoosh, you know, like Enterprise.
And it's the Enterprise.
Yeah, that would be... That would be fantastic.
And I think it needs to be a bit like in Supergirl as well, where there was hints of Superman there, but we didn't see him until season two.
Mm-hmm.
Because Supergirl needed to stand on its own as a show without relying on that. And I think this is the same. I think they need to survive without the Enterprise and have that as either a season finale thing or season two, have it pop up, you know.
It's funny, I was just going to use the analogy of having Enterprise related information on screens, never spoken about, never focused on, but like, you know, you're over the shoulder on a computer screen and, you know, first officer and captain are talking about something really important. And on the other screen is, you know, like, you know, incoming message, you know, like Enterprise D, Enterprise A or something like that. Like just little things that fans would be just like, whoa, you know, but not even looked at or touched by any of the actors. Like it's all just, they're focusing on screen left, but it kind of pops up screen right somewhere. Like that kind of thing would be really cool. Of course I was like, why am I thinking like that? But you know, when you mentioned Supergirl, of course she texts Clark a lot in the first season. And it serves its purpose. Like it's a fun little nod. It reminds everybody of the universe that you're in, and the kind of the personal frustrations, you know, that Supergirl goes through. So that's cool. I didn't realize it was so close. I knew I was remembering that it was between Enterprise and Kirk, but I'm surprised that it's so close to Kirk. Like you'd think that they would try to like give themselves a buffer speed, you know, at least a buffer where Kirk isn't born yet. So like they don't have to deal with that.
It's partly because they're still bringing themselves into a lot of canon. And they've even said that there's been times when they've looked at what Enterprise did and went, oh, if they hadn't done that, that would have given us a bit more flexibility.
Yeah,
because now that's canon. You know, like they've met the Ferengi, so great. So now that's set.
The Zindi and all that kind of stuff.
A lot of people were criticizing it, saying it could have taken place after Voyager, you know, and stuff. But I can understand why they've done it when they have. So the original creator, Brian Fuller, who's no longer involved, but he wanted to bring back some of the fun of the original series and some of that era where there was a lot of uncertainty of things, which I kind of appreciate and I get. And the state of the galaxy at this point is that straight after Enterprise finished, there was going to be another season. And that following year is when the Romulan War was supposed to happen. So they were trying to build up a lot to that.
Mm-hmm.
So Earth ends up in a massive war with the Romulans. And the interesting thing about this is nobody knows what a Romulan looks like until the original series. So up until that point, all dialogue is done over radio. Now, the Romulans are very suspicious of the Federation and so on. And they ended up in a war that lasted about 4 years. And so everybody's kind of reeling from that. The galaxy is kind of, the Federation have kind of built themselves back up. They're now back out and exploring. There will be a lot of people who will have memories of the war, but that's kind of starting to fade now.
This is in Discovery?
This is in Discovery, yeah. So this is this point here. But tensions with the Klingons have been getting worse. So in Enterprise, And this has been ever since the original series. In the original series, they were referring back to Cold Wars with the Klingons, that there'd been skirmishes and stuff. Enterprise really showed that our first contact with Klingons was that we shot one of them.
Mm-hmm.
A farmer shoots a Klingon in the very opening scene of Enterprise, and then Archer and the crew try to return him, completely unaware of Klingon customs. And one of the most shameful things that a Klingon warrior can do is not die in battle. If you're going to die, you're going to die in battle. And he didn't. And so he was shamed. He was dishonored. And humans were seen as dishonorable as well. And with all the other stuff that happened, like all the interactions between humans and Klingons, were just seen as a dishonorable species that they do not like and trust.
Mm.
And so now we're at a point where war is pretty much breaking out. And this is one of the things that's quite different, in that all the other shows have been mostly about exploration, or in the case of DS9, sitting and waiting for things to discover them.
Mm-hmm.
but that ended up with a war happening in it as well. There's a science officer called Stamets or Stamets. I can't remember exactly how it's pronounced. He's a lieutenant there. He's an astromecologist, and I love that they're sort of being specific about what kind of science officers these guys are now. It's not like, oh, he's a science officer. They've been very specific with it as well. And he signed up to be a scientist. He signed up to explore, and suddenly he's finding himself in a military position in the middle of a war that he does not want to be a part of.
No, he specializes in fungus.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's great, to be honest, because when you think of what it must have been like in the war when people were drafted, people were going about their lives, doing the things that they loved, and suddenly they're drafted into war and have very little choice about it. You know, there's also a lot of concerns that we have present day about what if certain actions by certain people in power could lead to war, and what would that mean to us?
Mm.
And I think it's a very very interesting and concerning sort of aspect to look at, really.
Yeah, I think it's gonna be good to have something like a Klingon war to kind of have some action and some drive, because that's something that I always found difficult when you're trying to get into a Star Trek series. And as you mentioned, Next Generation was very serious off the start, and it's hard to kind of get into and get to know the characters. But I mean, a great way to get to know your characters is put them in peril, put them in tense situations, like right off the bat, especially situations that they're not prepared for, and I find that, with television shows, that's generally, a way to kind of push characters into the audience's hearts and minds, because they can identify and all that kind of stuff and see like that kind of stuff unfold. I'm curious, from my own like kind of mental timeline, because I was a big TNG fan, and I know that at that point they're at peace with pretty much everybody except for the Cardassians?
The Cardassians, they have a non-aggression treaty with.
Okay. So who are the big... I mean, it's the Borg that are the big bads in TNG. But like, so what, the Romulans still?
Yeah, so the Romulans, there was a peace treaty that was made, and they have a neutral zone. The Romulans still kind of keep to themselves for a long time, especially... I think around this time, around the time of Discovery, I think they're dealing more with threats from species like the Gorn and the Tholians. And so they didn't pay much attention to the Federation after the war. Like, after that, I think they were kind of doing other stuff.
Mm.
But certainly by the time of Next Generation, it was definitely a bit like that.
Yeah, because I'm just trying to figure out, obviously we've got... Discovery's got the Klingons. Enterprise had the Zindi and the Klingons. And... in TNG, it was mostly the Romulans and the Cardassians, right?
Yeah, the Cardassians was more like they kind of appeared at the beginning, well, more towards the end of Next Generation. But they ended up being a spin-off on Deep Space Nine, where for a long time it was the Cardassians. They end up in a war with the Klingons as well, but the main enemy is the Dominion.
Right. So it's a faction, not an entire race.
Yeah, but they're run by the changelings, and they have their own soldiers that they basically genetically engineer and produce themselves.
It's been a long time since I've seen DS9. so after DS9 was Voyager, and Voyager, because of the nature of the show, they didn't really have a specific like main alien race that they had to deal with all the time as the bad guys.
Right? No, they started with the Kazon, which were supposed to be their kind of answer to the Klingons.
Right.
That didn't quite work so well. They were supposed to be a warrior race, but were not as technologically advanced.
Mm.
And then as they moved out of Kazon space, then we start to see other ones. We start to see the Borg a lot more after Star Trek First Contact.
Right. Yeah. No, and I think that's one of the reasons why I find Voyager was a little bit boring in that it was just more Borg. And I was like, well, okay, I get it, but you know, maybe we can come up with something else. That's one of the reasons why
I
was... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it was also a lot of Alien of the Week, and the prosthetics were mostly just, there's a different kind of forehead ridge or nose ridge or, or just something different happened to the ears and stuff. Yeah. There wasn't as much variety there.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think one of the reasons why, I don't want to say I was disappointed, but I was really hoping when I heard about the next Star Trek, you know, potential series, I was hoping for something beyond Voyager, like give us another couple hundred years out there sort of thing, just to kind of have like a clean slate, still have the spirit of Star Trek, but really kind of push it out there and not have to have like the ties to some of the old, you know, conventions that they had. But at the same time, you know, knowing what little I do about Discovery, having most of it being conversations with you, I'm excited to see kind of like the idea of something new, but then also if they do it right, and it sounds like they're really trying, how it's going to weave together with existing canon. And being so close to Kirk actually is more interesting to me, I think, than had it been somewhere like safe distance from both Enterprise.
Like halfway in between kind of.
Yeah, like if they kind of give themselves like this weird middle ground, it's like, well, that's great. You're not, there's no risk involved there. But this, like, there's a real, like, they really have to, you know, write carefully. And I feel like it's potentially going to be some really good fan service. Not in that they're going to be writing, you know, for fans, but if they're tying things in as closely as they probably have to this close to Kirk's era, then without like slamming it in your face, some people that are really well versed in Star Trek are probably going to pick up on things that like people like myself, my dad, you know, won't. I mean, we'll watch it, we'll enjoy it, but someone's going to name a planet and we're going to be like, all right, that's what we're going next. When somebody else is going to be like, oh, that's the planet from, you know, that, you know, Kirk's cousin died on, or, you know, just like little things like that are going to be really rewarding, you know, for people that have been longtime fans of Star Trek. But I'm looking forward to just actually being like part of, you know, a pop culture event that's happening right now in Star Trek, as opposed to, you know, catching up on things later. Because the thing is, like, when you want to watch it and you want to catch up on it, it's daunting. Even when it's a show that's, you know, was on air for 4 seasons and got canceled, like Enterprise. Like, it's still a lot of material to go through. Right.
Absolutely. I mean, it's 50 years worth, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, we've had 50 years of Star Trek. Obviously, a lot of breaks in between.
Yeah.
Some of them, but it's still a lot of stuff.
That's a lot of stuff. How, I mean, yeah, between is Star Trek or Doctor Who older?
Doctor Who is older.
Is it really?
And yeah. Because that was, I can't remember off the top of my head when it started, but yeah, Doctor Who was definitely first, because TV was still very much black and white back then.
Wow.
But yeah, they've Doctor Who had a 50th just before Star Trek, so it's not much time between them.
Right. Okay.
But Doctor Who definitely had more episodes, I would say.
Oh, yeah. But still, like...
The nature of British television with the serials at the time.
Yeah. To be able to say, though, that we live in an era where there's two massive sci-fi franchises that have been around for 50 years is bananas.
Mm. And they're going to be developing stuff so much. Like, when you look at... you know, at the Klingons, like just the amount of depth that they're changing in them. And this isn't being done by people who are just kind of coming in and they're like, oh, we're fans of stuff. The team working on this are Star Trek alumni. So you've got Brian Fuller, who helped sort of create and pave the direction that the show has taken. And he was a writer on DS9 and Voyager. He was the executive story editor for Voyager. We've got Alex Kurtzman, who's an executive producer, and he was the producer and writer for both J.J. Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness. Joe Minoski is one of the staff writers. He was a producer for TNG and Voyager. He wrote for TNG, Voyager, and Deep Space Nine.
Wow.
And then we've even got Nicholas Meyer, who is one of the writers and a consulting producer, and he wrote... he was uncredited for Star Trek 2, but he wrote a huge portion of Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan. He wrote Star Trek 4, The Voyage Home. He wrote Star Trek 6, The Undiscovered Country. And he was a director for both Star Trek 2 and Star Trek 6. And if you're noticing the numbers, those are the even-numbered ones. Those are the ones that are regarded as the best of the classic movies.
Yeah, I mean, you're listing my favorites.
He's a writer on this show. Jonathan nice. Frakes is going to be, who's obviously Riker in TNG. He directed First Contact and Insurrection.
Several TNG and episodes.
Several,
too.
And DS9 and Voyager episodes. He's done several of those, and he's going to be directing one of the episodes of this. And even Rod Roddenberry, who's Gene Roddenberry's son, so the creator of all of Star Trek, his son is an executive producer, and he's been doing a lot of Trek-related things. And he's involved. So there's a load of people who are really passionate and experienced with writing the world that we all love. So even though it looks very different to what we've seen before, it's in good hands.
Nice.
And some of the stuff they're doing with the Klingons, especially, there's been a lot of criticism about the look aesthetically to them, because the Klingons do not look like the Klingons that we know.
Cool. So interesting. I haven't actually seen a photo. The only photos I've seen have been just basically like whatever's popping up here on the main CBS site. Like all just the promotional poster stuff, a couple images of the main. I've seen mostly articles and things advertised where it's the cast members out of costume. So I know kind of like who's
a lot of that.
Going, but I haven't seen. There's one here, I think it was, well, you know what it was? It was when I was looking up the McFarlane toy thing, they had a picture of the first officer in her uniform. And I was like, okay, that's, you know, it's recognizably Star Trek. It's a little different, but it's not like, you know, out of left field. I like the new pin. I like the new, the badge with like the, it's got like
the Delta, as it's called.
Is that what it is? Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they've got the
Delta insignia.
It's got like a chip out of it or it's got a depth change that I don't recall from before, but yeah, I think it's really cool.
The Klingons have a very different look to them. Their heads are a little bit more elongated backwards.
Oh, interesting.
They have not just ridges on the forehead, but it goes all the way down the back of their heads. It goes to the sides. They have no hair at all.
Weird.
Yeah, they have, their uniforms look like they're made of bone with spikes on them and stuff. So visually speaking, they are completely different. And this has led a lot of people to kind of kick off and complain and go, it's not canon, it doesn't look like Star Trek. But there's two things about that that make me feel that this is actually better. The first being, if we really had them looking exactly the same as they did before, it's going to look dated right off the bat. So there needs to be a change. In the same way that the JJ movies updated a lot of the visual stuff It has to be done because otherwise people look at it and go, well, this looks cheap. You know, but the other thing is that we've had the Klingons for so long. They're supposed to be this big threat, but we're used to them. They're not as scary and disgusting and displeasing to look at as they were when they first appeared. And so having them look so different and alien, it makes you kind of go, I don't like the look of them.
Yeah. Do they all have really awkward dentures? Because that was one of the things that always bothered me about Klingons in the shows. I think it's one of the things I liked so much about how they handled it with Michael Dorn is that because he was only half Klingon, he didn't have Klingon teeth.
Oh, no, he was fully Klingon.
Was he?
Yes. He was raised by humans when his parents were killed.
I'm not sure how...
So he was adopted by human parents, the Rozhenkos.
He was one of the only Klingons that I've ever watched on a show that I understood. Like everybody else sounds like they've got a, you know, the dentists have got like the big mouth, the mouth guards in there. If everybody else always, especially, I don't know why I'm remembering this. I don't remember their names, but they were sisters.
The Duras sisters.
Yes.
Lurso and Beetle.
And both of them spoke like they had hockey mouth guards in.
Mm.
It was like the costumer just didn't decide, oh, yeah, this is a little big. You'll be fine. You don't have to act or anything. You know, like it's just, so I'm hoping that there's none of that. Cause that's the kind of thing that takes me right out of it. It's like, well, he's obviously trying, but it's a little bit, you know, over the top. Actually, you know what? To bring it right back to where we started, Sam Jackson, Samuel L. Jackson is in Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, and he has a huge prosthetic set of teeth in, and he does pretty well, but there's a couple of moments you can tell that he's like, well, like I'm really struggling to talk over these things, you know, because again, it's all practical, you know, practical makeup and stuff like that in the Tim Burton movie. But yeah, so I'm hoping that the Klingons don't have to like speak through their teeth, or I guess they're probably going to be speaking mostly Klingon and not English. So maybe it's not going to matter.
But yeah, and they are going to be like, the actors have had to actually learn Klingon for this, you know, which again, they're having to, just for the attention to detail with the kind of show that they're coming into.
Yeah.
They're also developing just the culture themselves. So, I believe in this, they've got 24 Klingon houses, because the Klingons always kind of separate themselves into their own houses.
Yep.
And they're developing that more. So it'll be a little bit more kind of Game of Thrones-esque, where you'll have them all kind of almost competing against each other as well at the same time. So there's going to be a lot more depth there than we've previously seen. And there's also going to be a ship that's about 200 years old, and the Klingon house that's part of that ship is a generational ship, and they're trying to be pure to the original teachings of Kalos, who was essentially their messiah. He's the one who started off the entire Klingon tradition of honor and their values and basically their entire system for how they do things around the galaxy. He was the one who kind of started it all off, which would have been around the 9th century for us. And so this is a generational ship that's been going on for 200 years. And it'll be interesting to kind of see how that all kind of plays in and whether they end up at war with, you know, like a bit of a civil war from that or, the, you know, and stuff.
Hmm.
We don't really know what's going on in that regard.
Yeah, well, and I guess it's kind of cool too, in that if they are changing them and they let everybody know that they're changing that the show is changing the Klingons a bit, then it keeps that sense of discovery. Again, terrible pun. I'm not sure if I'm on board with the name of the show, but it gives you that kind of like, okay, well, I understand the gist of Klingons, but if this is going to be a different take, then at least I probably can't predict all the things that are going to happen. So,
I do like that they're not treating them as the villains.
Yeah.
They're not having it as they have done in the past, where it's like, these are the bad guys and we need to defeat them. Mm-hmm. Star Trek is all about, how do we get to peace. And the Klingons are going to have a really strong viewpoint of, you're telling us that we should follow your values. We don't agree with them. You can't just push your values onto us because you feel that that's the right thing to do. You know, and so there's going to be a lot of exploring just differences in cultures in addition to what they have in common.
Yeah, no, and again, like, I mean, I'm excited for a new take on Star Trek. I don't know enough about the show to say that I've got one particular thing that I'm looking forward to most. I think I'm probably just looking forward to what Star Trek usually does best, which is just explore kind of like a little bit of a mirror, you know, in terms of what's happening in the world, you know, around us. Yeah. And then seeing that reflected in some of the writing and some of the cultural things and whatnot. From the sounds of it, I'm going to guess that maybe the Klingon stuff is something that you're looking forward to in terms of like the thing that you're looking to forward to the most.
Well, it's the overall arc of season one. So there's going to be a lot of the Klingons in there. I am just sort of interested in just the different take that they're doing, because they just seem to be adding a lot more depth. They're also embracing a lot of stuff in the way that Star Trek always has as well. Like, they put a black female officer on the bridge for the original series. For Next Generation, they took one of the biggest enemies of the Federation and put him on the bridge as well, with Worf as a Klingon. Mm-hmm. You know, and so they've always kind of pushed for stuff there. We had a black captain for Deep Space Nine. We had a woman captain for Voyager. In this one, it's a very multicultural cast. There's you know, people with different sexual orientations as well. So there's two officers who are both gay and you know, and have each other as a love interest there. So there's a lot of stuff that they're doing, but not as we're having to just tick boxes. It's really just, it's who they are and just part of how things are run, in the same way that Uhura on the bridge was just, she's on the bridge.
Yeah.
Because it's an equal society. And
yeah.
I think that that's great. And that's something that is definitely needed these days.
Yeah. No, and they did some of that with the J.J. Abrams movies as well, in terms of balancing out, you know. I mean, they obviously had to kind of go with, because it's the same characters from the original series that kind of had to balance it out. But I feel like they've made some adjustments here and there. Even with something as subtle as like Spock's emotions, like, I think it makes it a little bit more identifiable and whatnot. So yeah, I'm curious to see. Actually, one thing that I haven't heard anything about, and don't tell me because I'm curious, to kind of find out on my own, but just in terms of any Vulcans and stuff, you know, in Discovery. So I've heard nothing. Like, I've heard about the Klingons, I've heard about the costumes, I've heard about, you know, different characters and like, you know, women and different roles in the show and all that kind of stuff. But there's one thing that has not been mentioned at all, and anything that's kind of crossed my plate has been Vulcans. And I'm a fan. I've always kind of liked Vulcans. So I'm
Vulcans Vulcans do take a very big role in this. And one of the characters that's in there is Sarek.
Okay.
Who is Spock's father.
Yeah, no, I knew that. Yeah, I remember that from TNG.
So, yeah, so he will be a role in that as well. So I won't spoil much else in terms of that. I mean, they've been good at holding back a lot of stuff as well.
Yeah, which is good.
But the Vulcans will be involved in there. Another character that's returning to Star Trek, which I'm really interested in, is Harry Mudd. So Harcourt Fenton Mudd, who was a merchant, a smuggler, a con man. He was, you know, quite the dirty kind of scoundrel kind of thing. Very womanizing. He, you know, had...
From what series?
From the original series.
Oh, the original series. That'd be why I don't know him.
Yeah. So he was quite established there. And he's been played by Rainn Wilson.
Who is?
He played Dwight on The Office.
Oh. Okay.
And he was also in Super as well. So he's done quite a lot of stuff. But he'll be good in the role. He's doing a much... he said he's doing a little bit of a darker take with him, but just because that's where he's at in his life and just the tone of the show as well. But it's interesting to see them bring back a character that will eventually be an annoyance for Kirk later on.
Interesting. Well, that's about all the time we have for Star Trek. I think we should probably maybe have you back on after the show's been out and we've had a chance to maybe watch a couple of episodes and kind of form some thoughts about it, because I'm definitely going to be watching. After all kind of like the knowledge that you bring to the buildup, I think, you know, having some, having that knowledge applied to actually having watched the first couple episodes, I think will really be really cool.
Sounds good.
So normally we record live on Wednesday nights, but we're recording a little bit earlier this week just because of HalCon. So you can pop by thecitadelcafe.com to find this show, other episodes as well. If you've got your own thoughts on Star Trek, I'd love to hear them. So email the show at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. You can find us, my name, on Twitter and Facebook. For me, you can find out more about what I'm doing at joelduggan.com, and also check out forgepublishing.com. That's going to be the home for all of my publishing efforts with Piper Thibodeau and her Daily Paintings book, as well as Ink Tank from Rob Momartz, which is coming up very, very soon. I've been putting some final touches on the Kickstarter page actually over the last couple of days. Last but not least, do check out Comics Coast to Coast, where myself, Brian Dunaway, and Matthew Ducharme interview comic creators, illustrators, and animators. Coming up this week, we're going to be talking to Kyle Marshall, who I believe is a character designer and storyboard artist on the Three Amigonauts, which is a new cartoon in the US. Alistair, where can people find you online?
On Twitter, I'm at imfly. I have my website, which is omyzod.com. I haven't really updated much on there, but I do have an article that was written about 3 months ago with my initial thoughts on Star Trek Discovery. So if you're interested, it's worth checking that out.
It absolutely is. I remember I read it at the time, and it's excellent because it's a lot of information, but it's a very concise article despite its size. You've been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only beam up two.